We are halfway through the book of Mark. And the book of Mark is basically divided up into two pieces. The first eight chapters have to do with just who is this Jesus Christ? The second question is exactly what did he come to do? Now you can imagine that this was confusing for the disciples and the people because they had no idea that God would ever come incarnate and live inside of human flesh. It's just inconceivable. Nobody would think of that. And so who is this Jesus? Is he just a good man? Is he a superb man? Is he somebody to emulate? Or could he be the Messiah? Is that what's going to happen? Or, of course, they never imagined there was divinity inside of him, fully human and fully divine. And so when I think about this first part of Mark chapter 8, or Mark 1 through 8, I think about the question, who is that guy? And, of course, that always reminds me of one of the movies I liked years ago, loved it, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Now, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were experts at robbing banks and trains, and they were also experts at avoiding posses. Except one time, the authorities and the fellows that ran the train got so tired of losing money that they came up with an ingenious scheme. They were pretty sure that one train that was going to have a lot of money on it was going to be robbed by Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And so the fellows that ran the train and the U.S. Marshals got together and had a second train that followed the first train, such that when the first train was robbed, the second train would come right up on them, and the six guys that were in the hand-picked men in that posse could wrap them up. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid saw the second train come up. They saw the six guys get out of the train with horses, and they got on their horses, and the great escape was gone. And if you've seen the movie, you know, this goes over several days, and there's one great line that's repeated several times at this movie during the next few days. As we come to today's passage, the focus sort of shifts between the first half of who is Jesus and begins to morph into the second half. What exactly did he come to do? He's been teaching and preaching. He's been healing. He's been relating to people. He's been dealing with enemies. He's been loving those that are outcasts. Is that why he came? Is that what he's going to continue to do until he becomes an old man and finally dies? Wait a minute. Could he be the Messiah? And is he going to come to do something like overthrow the Roman government and bring peace and prosperity? Maybe another time like the realm of King David. Those were sort of the two things that wonder. And what today's passage is in just a microcosm is this. Number one, where Jesus says, I am a king, but I'm not the kind of king you're thinking of. I am a different king. And secondly, my mission has to do with a cross. And the cross is going to be the metaphor for how, or the way in which you are saved. And then for you and I and the disciples, the cross is a metaphor for how we live. That's a little summary of our passage today. In Mark chapter 8, we begin. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked them, who do people say that I am? Now, he'd been around for about 3 years. And there was sort of this talk all around. Different theories were going on. And they replied, some say John the Baptist, who is now dead, that he'd come back as John the Baptist. Others say Elijah, perhaps thinking about the prophecy in the book of Malachi 400 years before. Still others, one of the prophets. In other words, there was some confusion about he's somebody special, but we're not sure who he is. In verse 29, Jesus asked the group and Peter, what about you? Who do you say I am? And Peter answered, you are the Christ. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone. Matthew records, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And the answer, Jesus says, well, you got the answer right, but don't take too much credit for that because you didn't come up with that yourself. God showed you that. He's revealed that to you, which is good. But the way you're thinking of Christ is not the same Christ that I am. Christ in Greek literature was usually a term for the anointing of a king. And Jesus was going to certainly be a king. And in the Jewish language, anointed had to do with usually with the Messiah. but what kind of Messiah? But it's not the one that you're thinking of, is the idea. And he drops the bombshell on them in the next verse. I don't think they ever saw this coming. Verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. I try to put myself in their shoes, having followed him for 3 years and heard him teach and preach and heal and do miracles and relate to the outcasts of society, deal with enemies. I would have seen a bright future for this fella. But the bombshell he drops off is quite complicated here. He first says that the Son of Man, meaning himself, it's a reference back to the book of Daniel, where there is a figure that comes sort of like a Son of Man, sort of this angelic, divine, we're not really sure kind of creature who this is. And Jesus picks up this term as a way to help people sort of connect the dots of who he is. He's speaking about himself in first person here. And then he says that he must suffer. A Messiah that's going to suffer? Now, nobody in Jewish history ever put that together. You have chapters like Isaiah 43, Isaiah 44, and Isaiah 53 that talk about a suffering servant, a suffering ruler, somebody that's going to suffer. But they never paired that together with the idea of a Messiah. It was inconceivable to Peter, as we'll see in a minute, that he, Jesus, would suffer. But I think the word that strikes me the most is the word must. He began to teach him that the Son of Man must suffer many things. And then at the end of that, he says, must be killed. In other words, this is not just perhaps as time goes on, or don't be surprised, or maybe you should make some contingency plans. We're not really sure what's going to happen in the future. He is very clear. God's plan is being played out, and these are the details to be ready for. These are two musts, suffer and be killed. Verse 32, Mark records, he spoke plainly about this, putting the cookies on the bottom shelf. So there could be no, oh, that's just the interpretation that one might say of the words here in verse 31. He left no room for ambiguity. Spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Kind of would have liked to have been there to see that. You know, Peter put foot in mouth first and then speak. And he does that here. And then Jesus turns to him in verse 33. And we start to see the paradox of the Messiah's mission. It is something very different than anybody saw coming. It's almost 180 degrees different, which really shouldn't surprise us if we know our theology regarding human nature. Verse 33, Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, and he rebuked Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Peter was thinking along the lines, I would, and you would. It makes absolutely no sense what you just said to us about who you are and what you're going to do. And I have a sense that that I understand this, because think of this. If you were going to come to overcome injustice, would the plan involve your dying in order to do that? Who would think up that plan? Or if you were trying to start a movement that we know now has gone on for 2,000 years, would it make sense to you to start that by dying at a young age? Or if you were going to overcome the problem of human sin and to try to do that on a worldwide basis down through the generations, would it make sense to you to die at the age of 33? It certainly didn't make sense to Peter. It would not have made sense to you or to me. If you're going to overcome wrong, do you do that by laying down your life and serving? And then if you are a king indeed and you have kingly power, are you going to make a difference by not wielding that power, but by gladly yielding that power? This is the paradox that he is putting before them. And what strikes me as I think about this is that right between this verse and the next verse, Jesus, as a way of transition, takes the metaphor of the cross. This is the method of which my mission is going to be accomplished. And he takes the cross as a metaphor for you and I and how we are to live. And as only Jesus can do, in four short verses, he lays out what I think of as four paradoxical ways of living and how we think. And they are 180 degrees diametrically opposed to what comes naturally to us. And these four verses are just astounding. In these four verses, before we look at them, they deal with four different time frames. The first time frame is me in the immediate. The second time frame he'll deal with is me in what we think of as my future. The third time is me as it relates to entering into eternity and my life in the afterlife. And the fourth time frame is when Jesus comes back a second time and wraps up all of human history. And that's it as far as life here. In four different verses, four different time frames. And he deals with four different drivers that drive all of us, whether we're aware of it or not, every day. And they're these. What motivates me and what's supposed to motivate me? What naturally, not in a good way, motivates me? What should motivate me? Number two, what aims do I tend to pursue? As opposed to, what aims should I pursue? Number three, what is it that I ultimately value? What is it I ultimately should value? And number four, what is my ultimate goal? And what should be my ultimate goal? And so I've tried to make this as simple as possible to try to understand the marvelous wonder in these four verses, thinking of them as sort of laws of life, or what's our strategy for living. And he's going to put out two very different strategies here. And the wonder of it is, the one that naturally comes to us is not the one to pick. Number one, strategy number one on the inside of every handout, I die to live. I die to live. Verse 34. He called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. The question is, how am I to think about me? And there's different ways that we use the word self, so this can get kind of confusing. But the word self, and the way he's using it, is that the easiest way to think of this is ego. What is it that I'm really trying to do with me? What am I trying to accomplish with me? And what comes naturally to us without even thinking is to fulfill me, to please me, to make my life more comfortable, to make sure that people love me and to make sure that people respect me. And we go about our life every day as purposeful creatures, whether we're aware of it or not, to accomplish the filling of self. And as we do, that makes sense to us. We hardly ever question that until there are messes that are made and there are bodies strewn around what we call drama. The opposite way is, he says, we must deny himself. There's something about ego that's going to make a mess. And the image that he gives of this ego, what needs to happen is, the picture of a cross is a picture of death. That in this given moment, in what I'm about to say, or how I'm about to act, or how I'm about to relate, in any given moment of my life with you, my natural instinct is going to make this to be about me, very subtly. And if I do that, it's a great mistake. The opposite is, there's something in my ego that needs to die. Oftentimes, I think the hardest to pick is as we're relating to one another, or as you're relating to people in your world during the week, or your spouse, or your kids, or people during the week at work. It is so easy, and it just comes so naturally. And we are generally so blind to this that in almost any conversation, I am trying to get you to respect me, like me, love me, say something that makes me feel good about myself. And what does not come naturally is to try to do that for you. Usually by answering or by asking questions, letting you have free rein in the conversation and tell stories that are of interest to you. It can be as subtle as things like this. And this happens every day. Law number one. Proverbs 14:12. There is a way that seems right to a man. In the end, it leads to death. What could be so wrong with this is how we think. And the writer of Proverbs says, just because you can't see the damage doesn't mean it's not coming. When I think about this in terms of being a human being, I think about, I want you to think about, let's suppose that you are going to the most important sales call you'll make all year. You've never been to the home office of this firm. You have the paperwork in front of you. You asked your secretary for the address of the home office you're going to, or you talked to your partner about this, and has he been there before? And he assures you he has. Maybe the boss has told you the importance of this, and you punch in the address into your phone or your GPS system. What you don't know is that your GPS system that day is faulty. You have no idea of knowing that. You drive to this appointment. You get there 7 or 8 minutes early. But when you arrive at the address, the company is not at that address. Now, what's the first thing you or I are going to think of? My secretary gave me the wrong address. My partner gave me the wrong address. My boss gave me the wrong address. Or the person I'm supposed to see gave me the wrong address. And you will probably get on your phone and ream out your secretary or ream out your partner or subtly tell your boss that he needs to get his game together. And when somebody gives you the correct address, which is the address you typed into your navigation system, suddenly you are eating humble pie. Because they gave you the right address, but the navigation system led you somewhere else. All the while, you just assumed that your navigation system was perfectly fine. This is what Jesus is telling us here. We just assume we know what to do. We know where to go. We know how to fill ourselves. It certainly does not mean saying no to myself and no to ego. Number one, I die to live. Number two, I lose to gain. The second law, I lose to gain. Whoever wants to save his life, or this verb in the Greek can also be translated find, whoever wants to find his life, will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Now, he's not talking about our physical life. The word he uses for life here is the Greek word psyche, which we get our word from psychology. And he's talking about the essence of who we are as a person, as people, or our identity. If I want to find myself, is what I used to think of when I was in college among my friends. The way to do that is to lose my life, but whoever loses his life for me in the gospel will save it. These are the two strategies at work. When I was in college, I had some friends whose parents were very wealthy. And I don't know, you know, sometimes, you know, parents are dumb. And I would include me on that list sometimes. And some of my friends who had wealthy parents somehow leveraged 3 months of room and board and transportation and money to live in Europe for 3 months to find themselves. I wish I could have been there to see this conversation and this negotiation is going on. And so off they went. Now, it shouldn't be a surprise that all my friends used the same methods to try to find themselves. It involved parties, booze, drugs, and plenty of sex. And when they came back from the summer, what they didn't know And what I didn't know at the time was that they had made the finding of themselves significantly more difficult. Because now what they had done is they had picked their strategy for how to do this, and they had different buckets. And they had tried to fill those buckets with some of the different strategies I just mentioned. And what happens in the human heart is that those buckets now crave for more. Because those things can feel like they fill the bucket temporarily, but over time, it feels like the bucket is getting bigger. Each one of these buckets is getting bigger. And it takes more and more and more to try to fill the bucket. This is the process, one of the ways that addictions happen. Jesus said, don't go down that road. It's not going to work. I lose to gain. Number three, filling others fills me. And here the question is, what is it that I really, really, really value most? Not what do I say I value? Because as human beings, we're able to say the right answers to a lot of questions. Or in the church world, to say the spiritual answer or the right answer. But the question, Jesus goes right down into the heart and says, no. I don't want your stated value. I want to know what it is you really, really, really value. And here the question is, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? And here he puts two things out here as things we value. The first has to do with the value of things or treasure or possessions or not limited to that, I think of status or importance. And we just, as naturally, we just naturally gravitate to those things again without even thinking. It just makes so much sense to us that that's how this happens. This is what I'm supposed to do. And yet what we don't see is that if this is our ultimate value, it comes at a heavy cost. And the cost is to what he describes as our soul or our heart or the person that we're becoming. Over here, if I think about this, we've had some different pictures of this that I related to recently. Yesterday, I was driving up Jeffrey Drive in my car. I was coming over here for men's breakfast, and next to me was a nice looking guy in a bright green Rolls Royce. Looked like he had just got it off the lot. He's driving in the middle lane, and we're driving up, and I'm in the right-hand lane, and we come up to a stoplight. And I look at this beautiful car, this green Rolls Royce. And then I look at my car. A 2000, with no numbers after that, 2000 Toyota 4Runner, and my engine light is blinking. I thought, I'll bet his engine light's not blinking. And in that moment, I was kind of caught in that vortex. And it made me think about, you know, years ago, I made a decision that I'm not going to live for what I now consider and what Jesus would consider here, trinkets or toys. Why? There are several reasons. One is that they are so temporary. They're not going to last. But my soul's going to last a long time. Who I am will last a long time. We took off and my car seemed to sputter. I think it was just as affected by sitting next to the Rolls Royce as I was. But it made me think as I was driving on of the different ways I could look at that Rolls Royce. There was a time in my life where I would have looked at that and gone, wow, that's what you're chasing. That's how it's supposed to be. And you know what image came to my mind after that? I thought, how should I think about this? And the image that came to my mind was, this is like when my kids were little and we used to go to Denny's or someplace like that. And you know the machine with the claw? You got all those stuffed animals and the claw. You know, my kids called it the ripoff game. No matter how much money you feed in there, we aren't coming away with anything. That's how I should look at that Rolls Royce. It's sort of the equivalent as one of those stuffed animals in the claw. Now, one of the stories I enjoy reading read about in history is Charlemagne, otherwise known as Charles I, King of France. And he was a very famous character in Western civilization, Charlemagne. He died around 820. And about 180 years later, the Emperor Otho decided to open up the tomb of the great Charlemagne. And so several men were there, and they went, and they opened up the tomb and walked in with some candles. And what they saw was astounding. They saw that there was a throne in the tomb. And Charlemagne's skeleton had been seated on the throne. The bones were sitting on the throne. And on his skull was Charlemagne's crown. And all around him were these trinkets and treasures. But somebody who had arranged this had also put a piece of parchment of the Gospels sitting on his lap, and had taken his right hand and his bony finger and had placed it on one particular place of the parchment. And when the emperor went over to look at it, and the guys that were with him, what the bony finger was pointing at was this verse. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? Now, this is a hard concept for us to really grasp. But we've had in our recent last few months in our American life several pictures that suggest something of what he's talking about here. And it's not just forfeiting our soul in the afterlife, like in hell, but there's an effect on the soul even in this life, something of that we are losing who we are, something of our reputation, our character, our integrity. It's almost like this person I am is slowly shrinking and hardening and pulling within about my own little world. The living examples of this that are most prominent to me is the name Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, and Dr. Nasser. What those folks did was wrong to the people around them. But it did not come without damage to those men. And they are paying a price that is long overdue within themselves and who they are. That's going to continue to play out. Law number three, filling others fills me. And then number four, I was made to please God. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. The idea here is something like this. Whether we admit it or not, all of us live to please somebody. And that usually goes in several directions. The scriptures assume that we always live to please ourselves as top priority. Although to us, it may look like my first priority is to please my children. What we can't see is that's a part of pleasing me. Even good things. Or we live to please God as most important, the highest value, the highest aim. Matthew 25, Jesus tells us a great parable. And at the end of the parable, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. It's that well done that comes from outside of us, not within us, at which we aim, which has the greatest impact in the human heart and the human soul. Years ago, in 1978, I had just graduated from the seminary. It was the year that we got married. And the London Times ran an article, an interview from the nephew of one of the most well-known authors of the Western world during the 1930s. Somerset Maugham was his last name. My last name is Maugham, M-A-U-G-H-A-M. middle name Somerset. Wilson was his first name. But if you're going to be called Wilson or Somerset, and you're a British, what would you pick? Somerset. Easy. Somerset Maugham. 1930s, he became wealthy beyond belief. He was a prolific writer of novels and short stories and plays. This fellow was somebody unique, and in some ways centric and a tragic figure. He was a self-avowed unbeliever, an agnostic, and when asked, "Why are you an agnostic?" what he said was, "I look around at the misery of the world and the bitterness of the world," sort of inferring his own struggle of life in this, "and it's inconceivable that God could exist, a good God could exist, given what I look around here." Then he was asked about the afterlife, notions of future punishment or future reward, and he said, "That notion is outrageous." He was married, I think, for 13 years to his wife, and then I think that ended. He was quoted often about a statement that he made to his nephew Robin, and I quote, as he told his nephew, "I tried to persuade myself," this is during the course of his entire adult life, "I tried to persuade myself that I was three quarters normal and that only a quarter of me was queer. Whereas really, it was the other way around." Now, in 1978, years later, his nephew Robin went to visit him in his old age. He had a huge home, an estate down on the French Riviera. And when Robin came back, of course, the London Times wanted to talk about what was it like to with the great author and what did he say. And so there was an interview, and it came out a few months just before we were married in 1978. And I want to read you an excerpt from that interview. Robin is speaking, his nephew, first person. "I looked around the drawing room at the immensely valuable furniture and pictures and objects that Willie's success had enabled him to acquire. I remembered that the villa itself and the wonderful garden I could see through the windows, a fabulous setting on the edge of the Mediterranean, were worth £600,000 sterling. Willie had 11 servants, including his cook, Annette, who was the envy of all the other millionaires on the Riviera. He dined off silver plates. He was waited on by Marius, his butler, and Henri, his footman." And then listen to what the nephew says next. "But it no longer meant anything to him." "The following afternoon, I found Willie reclining on a sofa, peering through his spectacles at a Bible which had very large print. He looked horribly wizened, and his face was grim." And then the quotation of a Somerset to his nephew. "I have been reading the Bible you gave me, and I've come across the quotation." And he reads, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? I must tell you, my dear Robin, that that text used to hang opposite my bed when I was a child. Of course, it's all a lot of bunk." Robin returned to London, had his interview with the reporter from the London Times, and reported, and near the end of the article, Robin goes on to describe his uncle in this way. "He is an empty, bitter old man who repeatedly fell into shrieking terrors, crying, 'Go away, I'm not ready. I'm not dead yet. I'm not dead yet, I tell you.' He was a man who gained the whole world, and it came at a terrible price, the loss of his soul." Let's pray together. Father, I'm struck that the cross was your method of bringing salvation to us as people. And the cross becomes a metaphor for how we live on a daily basis, or how we ought to live on a daily basis, if we're going to find ourselves really following you. And the instincts, our disposition, our drivers, are all set in the wrong direction. But rather than letting that discourage us, it should make us marvel at the wonder of grace. That even yet, as your children, that you still take us as we are. People in process. People are still with something faulty inside that you are slowly fixing. We marvel at your mercy and grace. Would you help us take these four laws of life that are such paradoxes to us? And would you help us, would you give us eyes to begin to see these in our daily life? Our choices, our actions, our words, as we relate. Help us to be, as we sang this morning, salt and light.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.